Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Ballot to Talk About. This week, we'll be looking back at results from the parliamentary election in South Korea and the recent state election in Tasmania, Australia, and asking the big question: despite remaining premier, why did Jeremy Rockley's Liberals lose their majority? It's Sunday, the 14th of April, 2024.
A president who seeks not to divide but unify.
Not now. I am not a fighter and not a quitter.
Crooked Joe Biden.
It's time for a change in this country, my friends. A real change.
Let's keep moving.
Slava Ukraini!
And joining me, as always, is my co-host Sam. Well, Sam, we've taken a little break since our last time, and the good news is that you're 1 hour closer to me now, isn't it?
Yes, yeah. And the sun's coming out, so that's always good. But yeah, how have you been in our break?
It is. Oh, I always love it during this time of seasonal change because it's definitely getting cooler on my side of the world. Definitely when I came back to Australia, it was a lot cooler than when I left Australia. So we're very much showing once again, we're talking to you from opposite sides of the world, aren't we?
Indeed. But Chen, it's a very big day in the theatre land today. Do you know why?
No. What's going on?
We have the Olivier Awards tonight.
Ah, the Olivier Awards, of course. I thought you were going to say something like Wrexham FC got promoted yesterday, but clearly that's not something I think you particularly
Well, big
care.
for Ryan Reynolds.
Well, there you go. I don't think there's Olivier Award for sporting achievements or running sports football teams, are there?
No. But interestingly, one of the front runners for best play and best actor in a play is Joseph Fiennes for Dear England, where he played Gareth Southgate in a play about the England football team. So there you go.
Lovely. So I'm keen to see who the winners and losers are from the Olivier Awards. And Sam, this week's podcast, we'll be talking about, we also have found out on our time away, several winners and losers of several elections. And we're getting to quite a busy point, would you not agree, in the political year, because we're going to have a series of elections coming out in May and June, some of which are incredibly consequential and mammoth in terms of their logistics. So we're preparing to ramp up for what could be a busy period. But we're starting tonight, Sam, would you not agree that the weekend in which I flew off from my holiday was the weekend in which Tasmanians went to the poll in the early election, an election we covered 3 years ago. So it's nice to see elections we covered then are coming back once again. And it's fair to say that the picture that has emerged after these elections is a lot more complicated for Tasmanian Premier Jeremy Rockliffe, isn't it?
And to be honest, Chen, it's actually a good job. Your holiday, I think, was conveniently timed because, particularly in the case of Tasmania, it was worth us waiting because the results were uncertain enough that it took until the confirmed counts and the allocations of preferences to be able to actually talk with confidence about the results. And also, given that Jeremy Rockliffe's Liberals fell short of the majority, it gave us some time to look at what kind of government he was going to form. But I'll give you a breakdown first of the overall results so you have a picture of that. So Jeremy Rockliffe's Liberals finished with 14 seats, which is an increase of 3, but their vote share fell 12.1% down to 36.7%. The Labour Party, 10 seats, which is up 2, and their vote share held roughly the same at just under 30%. The Greens, up 3 at 5 seats, 13.9% of the vote, which is an increase of 1.5%. The Jackie Lambie Network had 3 seats from no representation, with 6.7% of the first preference vote. And there are now 3 independents sat in the National Assembly of Tasmania. The former Labour leader David O'Byrne in Franklin, Christy Johnson in Clark. They were both re-elected, although David O'Byrne now as an independent rather than a Labour member. And Craig Garland was newly elected in Braddon. So we have quite a new look parliament. And you may think, hang on, pretty much everybody gained seats in that election. Well, that's because, as we explained last time, the Tasmanian National Assembly was increasing its seat count by 10 to go to 35 seats, which meant that each constituency now elected 7 members rather than 5. And we'll come on to talk about that because I think that had quite a big impact on the overall government formation and also the representation in the parliament as well. And we now have a confirmation that Jeremy Rockcliffe will be remaining premier in a minority government, but he's signed a confidence and supply agreement with the Jackie Lambie Network to govern, and he's also in talk with other independents, such as, interestingly, David O'Byrne, to provide confidence and supply on big issues as well, because notably, Liberals plus the Jackie Lambie Network is still one seat short of an overall majority. So, an interesting term ahead for Jeremy Rockcliffe, probably a very different term than he led in the last election up until the Laura Alexander's resignation took them out of majority. But, Chern, your reaction to these results?
I think there's several interesting things to say about these results. First of all, this was n at the outset, I think, let's be frank. Jeremy Rockcliffe wanted a strong, stable majority government. He's not got that, has he? So, from that metric alone, I wonder how much trouble he has stored for himself further down the road when, the Liberals have won their fourth term. They've never, it's a historic fourth term. They've never governed Tasmania for that long period. But it is often the Liberals were looking for majority and they fell way short of that majority. So I think that's the first thing to say. So the Liberals can be considered, whilst they've returned to government, they made their lives hard. It's not the mandate they wanted. And one of the things by waiting so long is that the Liberals actually have 14 seats rather than 15 seats. Craig Garland, the independent, was able to garner enough preferences from all the other candidates to be elected into the last seat in Braddon, where he defeated what would have been a fourth Liberal candidate. And the machinations of that is that Jeremy Rockcliffe could have made 15 seats work, because in that case, you only would have needed him and the Jackie Lambie Network, and you would have a majority on the floor of the parliament. But because Craig Garland took that last seat, and Craig Garland is independent, he has been, yes, he is more, co he was anti-vax, he's considered anti-vaxxer during COVID, but on many other issues, such as on salmon farming, he's often associated with the centre left. So therefore, I think, Jeremy Rockcliffe would have to, that's why he's looking out at people like David O'Byrne, ironically, to try and get that to get another independent across the line, or at the very least nominate an independent to be
And
speaker, because at the
actually,
moment,
and both Craig Garland and Chrissie Johnson have been very critical of Jeremy Rockcliffe's government's work, particularly on the Integrity Commission and anti-corruption as well. So there is a lot of work to be done if he wants to win them over.
and also on the stadium policy as well, Craig Garland, I noticed, was not a fan of the stadium policy. So there is a lot more work to be done there. So I think waiting for the votes to play out has not done Jeremy Rockcliffe any good. But that being said, I don't think Labour's had a good night either. Because yes, Labour's increased its seat share to 10, but I'll just cast your mind back, Sam. They also had 10 seats in 2018 when the Liberals won their second term. So in other words, the Labour Party has just basically, in essence, returned to what its position was in the 2018 election. And I can tell you, at that 2018 election, they had 33% share of the vote. And now they have 29% share of the vote. So I find it remarkable that the main opposition party in Tasmania, 2 elections later, has got less number of votes in both numerical and vote share than it did 2 elections ago. Absolutely extraordinary, isn't it?
I mean, it's also the fact that in a situation where the Liberal Party lost 12.1% of the vote in a predominantly two-party electoral system, yes, I'm sure we'll come on to talk about the absolute boom in third-party representation in Tasmania, but still, it's broadly two-party in Australia. The fact that you can have the government party lose over 10% of the vote and the main opposition barely changes their vote share at all, I think is pretty extraordinary as well for the Labour to not be beneficiaries seemingly in any way of a complete liberal collapse in their share of the vote, I think is extraordinary. And also the liberals gained 3 seats where Labour gained 2. So actually the governing party, who were performing worse than last time, actually benefited slightly more from increasing the parliamentary representation, which I think is also an interesting facet of this as well.
I wonder, Sam, do you think Labour has a northern problem? Because what's interesting to me is that I looked at the last time that that the 1996 election, where it was the last time the parliament was at 35 seats. And yes, at that time, circumstances were slightly different, but Labour at that time at 14 seats. And what was striking from my point of view was that in Lyons and Bass, they both had 3 seats each. I'm wondering, Sam, do you think that Labour potentially has a northern problem in terms of appealing to the north, in certainly to the north of the demographic? Because that's where that's where, particularly in Bass, for example, the Liberal vote did collapse quite a bit, but that vote seemed to have gone to the Jackie Lambie network, isn't it? For example, Braddon is Lyons is a good example. This is a seat where Rebecca White is standing. What we did see was that the Liberal vote crashed 14%. But the Jackie Lambie network to 8%, and the Labour Party were in the leader's seat, their vote went up by 0.2%. So I wonder, is there a northern problem, do you think, for the Labour Party?
Potentially. I mean, one interesting thing is I think you see the same sort of representation on the federal level as well. So for the Labour Party, they were try to be competitive in Bass. I know it was one of the seats talked about as one of the biggest swing seats to watch, and yet the Liberal Party ended up retaining that seat, actually on a slightly increased share of the vote from the federal election previous in 2019. But so I don't think it's a particular northern problem on the state level, because you actually see the same kind of results reflected even when Labour are doing pretty well on the federal level as they were in 2022. But particularly if Labour's going to make headwinds, it is in those northern seats that they're going to have to sort it out, because that's where you saw their vote share across the candidates as slightly lower. But I don't see it as a huge alarm bells on the state level, particularly mainly because you see fairly similar results on the federal level.
So the question is that if it's not that, is Tasmania, which was historically seen as a Labour state, this is Labour's longest period in opposition now, it's the only state in state level and in federal level that the Labour Party does not control. Is Tasmania's demographics making it harder for the Labour Party to compete, do you think?
I think there is some truth to that. I think obviously Tasmania in many ways is slightly removed from some of the more mainland states of Australia by one, by geography, and two, by its demographics, because it doesn't tend to have the big cities that the other Australian states tend to have. I mean, Hobart is nothing compared to your Melbournes, your Brisbanes, your Sydneys. It's just not, it doesn't have that same level of infrastructure or your sort of young urban population that you tend to get concentrated in those other city areas. So I think Tasmania generally has a slightly different demographic to Australia, the mainland Australian states more widely. And that's, I think, one of the main reasons why you see still all mainland Australian states and territories are represented by Labour for now. And Tasmania is the outlier. I think it does have a lot to do with the different demographics. That's not to say that Labour remain uncompetitive there, because I still think, in their heart of hearts, I think it's a more naturally Labour part of Australia. But I think at the moment, we are seeing that demographic divide pretty starkly.
I think it's an education divide more fundamentally, actually. And it's something which, we talk about politics around the world and electoral trends all around the world, is something in which that it is education is a fundamental cleavage in political and how people vote. The reality is that Tasmania, among all the Australian states, has a lower completion of high school rates compared to other states in Australia. It's got a lower share of its population with bachelor and university educated. In the north of the state, there is a lot of reliance on the forestry industry, on the salmon industry, and a lot of agriculture-based industries. So it's a big working class population in Tasmania that in the past would have been the
Particularly
bedrock
in the
of Labour
north.
support, particularly in the north. In 2004, that's when things began to change. That's because the Labour Party lost Braddon and Bass at a federal level over issues related to forestry, for example. And I think, or in recent years in particular, Labour has struggled to regain its foothold in the north. And this is what I was hinting at. And particularly given the demographics and the industries that have relied there. And I think it is to a large extent becoming a more challenging state for them. But at the
I
same
mean, you,
time,
Chern, you're seeing this across the board with a lot of social democratic parties around the world, is that you're finally balancing your more traditional roots, which is your like industry, unions, heavy machinery, or the more working class roots, with the newer version of social democratic politics, which is your like young, urban, socially liberal. They just tend to be two very different cleavages you're trying to finally balance. And you see that with a lot of social democratic parties. And I think you see it here in the distinction between how Labour wants to operate federally on mainland Australia, where it's appealing to a very different demographic in some of the southern states of mainland Australia, compared to what it's looking at in northern Tasmania.
so we're told a lot about the demographic factors that have made this state potentially challenging for Labour. But can we, is the Labour campaign also at fault, do you reckon? Do you think Rebecca White was a drag on the vote?
I think inevitably she was a little bit of a drag, and I think, but to a certain extent, it's not a hugely her fault because she almost unintentionally was leading Labour into a third successive campaign. Because after her last failed campaign to take Labour back into government in Tasmania, she resigned as leader of the Labour Party. And of course, she ended up back as leader because David O'Byrne's leadership imploded very rapidly. And so I think it's very difficult for a party to conduct any kind of the necessary introspection or transformation required after a third successive election loss when you have to unexpectedly retain the leader who's lost you the previous two elections. Yes, Labour could have had a leadership election again, but that would have been unnecessarily messy, and also there weren't any clear candidates at that time to replace David O'Byrne so quickly after he'd replaced Rebecca White. So I think, yes, it's difficult. And also, she's had to fight two snap elections because the preparation for an election where you want to go back into government can be very tricky when you're caught off guard by these elections coming round, and all of them, both of them, were motivated by the government deciding to call an election rather than it being forced upon them by the opposition, even though arguably that would have inevitably happened late last year. But still, it's very different you feeling confident about election and forcing one upon the government than the government thinking, well, we're a bit vulnerable with our majority, so we're going to call one ourselves. Yes, I think Rebecca White was a drag, but I don't think it was anything to do with her politics. I think it was more about just her representing that the Labour Party has not changed.
Well, my view is that I think it's more a reflection on the campaign machine of the Labour Party more than herself. Like you said, she tried to stand down at the last election, but they completely effed up, if for want of a better term, the leadership succession race, and David O'Byrne's leadership spectacularly imploded. And I think at that stage there was no obvious candidate for leader because apart from Rebecca White returning, I think she's seen as a she's able to pull a quota in her own right in Lyons, which is that central seat, which is a difficult thing to do, as we often talk about that demographic change, as we talk about the more north you become, the harder it is for the Labour Party. She is able to get a quota in its own right, as usual, opposition leaders usually do. So that's a tick to suggest that she has somewhat of a personal following. But I think it's more a reflection of the Labour Party machine behind her. And a comment on the snap election issue, this time around in 20, I think that being caught off guard, I definitely think that was a greater element in 2021. She was also pregnant. I think she was 8 months pregnant at the time as well, the 2021 campaign. But Sam, in 2024, let's be honest, Lara Alexander and John Tucker have been causing all kinds of problems for the government over the last 6 months or so leading up to the election. So there was always this possibility that the election could be called early, given the fact that the Rockliffe government already then was already struggling in minority. So I think this idea of not being prepared, the warning signs were there of a early election, and yet it seems as if the Labour Party was not able to mount an effective campaign to highlight the chaos of the Liberals over the last year, the last 6 months to a year or so.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is definitely truth in that. And obviously the Labour Party were repelling on two sides, because you had the Liberals campaigning for a full term, and then you had the Greens campaigning to increase their representation, and naturally they bleed more support from, they gain more support from former Labour voters than they would from former Liberal voters. So maybe there is a battle on two sides element to this as well. But yeah, I think Rebecca White struggled. And it was, I think there is a lot to be said of how can the Labour Party prove that it's changed into an election-winning machine when you've retained the same leader who's lost the last two successive elections? I think there is a tricky argument
You know what they
there.
say,
And
Sam? The definition of idiot is to do the same thing but expect a different outcome, isn't it? And that's exactly what, in some ways, the crude, what it could be boiled to as well. I should say as well that Labour has selected a new leader. Dean Winter in Franklin is the new leader of the Tasmanian Labour Party. He was elected unopposed as leader. And Sam, I'm not sure if you heard about what happened to Dean Winter, and I think this is emblematic of the problems facing the Labour Party over this little while. Did you hear about how Dean, what happened to Dean Winter in the 2021 campaign? So Dean Winter was the very popular mayor of Kingborough, which is a little city in within the Franklin electorate. In the 2021 campaign, he was actually barred by the Labour Party, the state Labour Party, from standing, and it took intervention for Rebecca White and the national executive to impose him as a candidate in Franklin. And he subsequently, and the result was that in the 2021 campaign, he subsequently topped the poll amongst in terms of which Labour candidate was able to get the most votes. And in one election campaign after that, or after once again topping the poll in 2024, we can see that he's now elected leader. So I think it does show you that there seems to be an administrative problem with the Labour Party in trying to knock back a popular mayor who subsequently went on to prove that he's a top vote getter for the Labour Party and is now the leader of the Labour Party itself.
very interesting. Chen, I think we can't talk about these Tasmania results without talking about the change in the makeup of Parliament and also the unique electoral system in Tasmania, because I think a lot of the issues for the main two parties come from the fact that, unlike the other mainland Australian states, you're not looking at first past the post single member districts. You're looking at five, seven member districts, of which they're allocated on a vote transfer, the Harley Clark system. So, what impact did you think that had? And do you think it did make a big difference to these overall results?
It made a big difference, I think. I think the one of the big winners will be the Greens, who now have who were one of the big beneficiaries, because what often happened, particularly in the last election in 2021, was that the Labour in the northern seats, the Labour Party and the Liberal Party basically divided all the seats up amongst each other, because the Greens didn't have a high enough vote to reach a quota of the number of seats necessary. Because if you think about it, you need 20% for a quota in a five-member district. Now that there are seven members of that, the quota has been lowered. The share, the vote that you need to reach a seat has been lower, and the Greens have been able to win a seat. And in some cases, they've been able to win more than one seat in some of these areas. I'm looking at Clark, for example, where they've won two seats, for example, a bit unexpectedly, some would say. They've returned, and like I said, the lower court has enabled them to return in Lyons and Bass. So I think that's the first thing to say, is that it's arguably what I would reckon made the parliament much more representative, because I'm looking at the results. I'm comparing the seat translation to, so I can tell you at this election, the Liberals got 37% of the vote and 40% of the seats. In the Labour Party got 29% of the vote, they got 29% of the seats. And the Greens got 14% of the vote and 14% of the seats. So it's actually remarkably proportional in this election compared to the previous election, which I think is very interesting. That if I were to compare that to the 2021 campaign, yes, Hare Clark, which is the system, is red produced a relatively proportional outcome last time, it could be argued, but with the expansion of those, it became even more proportional. So I think that is that's something to be noted of, is that there is greater proportionality with this increased number of seats. Minor parties have certainly benefited from it, and it is and more fundamentally, I think what it's enabled to do is you see that in the cabinet as well, is that the Liberals just have more bodies on MPs to be able to sit around the government because they sit in the lower house, for example, and hopefully that will mean that ministers will become less loaded on portfolios, and it will mean that the burnout that many other ministers had in the last term, that will be significantly reduced in this term. So I would say that's had a
Yeah,
big
I mean,
impact.
our thoughts go out to the one Liberal member of the National Assembly who has not been given any role or any ministerial portfolio or speakership because of the distribution of those ministerial things. But we'll come on to that in a second.
I will say just a point on that. He is a newly elected MP though, so there's a reason why he was.
Day one, ministerial responsibilities.
Well, Eric Abetz, who is the newly elected MP for in Franklin, has gone straight into the cabinet as Minister for Business, Industry and Resources, and the Minister for Transport and Leader of the House. So, you know, but that being said, he was a federal senator, a federal minister for employment, and was the leader of the coalition government in the upper house of Senate. So it's not as if he hasn't had ministerial experience, but I think you're right, Sam. I think it's like seven lower house cabinet ministers, one speaker, four parliamentary secretaries, which means only one backbencher. Surely it does not mean every question time he answers, he gets to ask 50 all the questions for the government
All of the
side.
questions. And Chern, interestingly, you talk about that electoral system. There's a big asterisk here because the Hare Clark quota would have been lower due to there being more seats available. But one thing I did find interesting is that if you look at those sixth and seventh seats in the different constituencies, five of the Liberals' 14 seats were either those sixth or seventh allocations. So is it possible that if this National Assembly hadn't expanded, that the Liberals would have done significantly worse than they performed in this system? Because a lot of Liberals are claiming that the electoral system sort of did them a fast one because they got 14 seats, but now there's an expanded parliament which would have been a majority previously. But perhaps they would have ended up in an even worse situation. Whereas how many of the sixth and seventh seats went to the Labour Party? Zero. So I find that quite interesting.
Well, I will say this, the Liberals had more votes. So therefore, in that competition to get the third seat or the third MP out, they would just have more votes to be in the equation for the sixth or seventh seat. So I think that's something to be said. And I wonder if there were only five seats available, what that equation or how that count will be run slightly differently. So I think that's just a small caveat to say on that. For those who are curious, both Lara Alexander and John Tucker were not re-elected, despite arguably being one of the main causes of this early election. John Tucker did slightly better than Lara Alexander, but he only got, I think, from what I saw, was about 0 point. Lara Alexander got 0.18 of a quota in her own right, and John Tucker got 0.25 of a quota. And for independent, we needed probably at least 0.4, which is what Craig Garland got, to be in the conversation for a seat. So I think it's fair to say they were quite some way off, would you not agree, of them being returning to Parliament one day?
Absolutely, absolutely. And Chen, the final question, focusing on the government. So obviously Jeremy Rockliffe now will be leading a minority government with the support of the Jackie Lambie network to get close to that majority line. Do you think that that will have a negative impact on his longevity as Tasmanian Premier? Because obviously Tasmania seems to have a bit of an issue with long-serving premiers. It seems to be pretty rare in Tasmania, but do you expect this term to last the full term? Do you expect Jeremy Rockliffe to still be there in 4 years' time? What's your hunch?
My hunch is that it probably will not be. But I think what is interesting is that I think he knows that there's some work to be done. Because what he has done, as I noted, is that he has, in the cabinet that he has announced, he has tilted the cabinet much more to the right. And that's a key of that is the elevation of Eric Abetz to be a minister straight into the ministry. He's, of course, was one of former Prime Minister Tony Abbott's right key lieutenants and was a strong ally of that hard right faction of the party. He's also, I noted, got rid of climate change as a portfolio name, is now no longer a portfolio name. It's within the bigger energy portfolio, which is held by Nick Durkin. So I think there are elements to tilt this cabinet to the right. And that is in reflection for the fact that the right of the party, and Jeremy Rockcliffe, I should say, is a moderate, is he's having to placate the right in order to remain in power within the Liberal Party. He notes that that was a problem. The right of the party were really upset with him over for issues like John Tucker and Lara Alexander leaving the party. They're both from the right of the party. Elise Archer, the former Attorney General, is also from the right of the party, didn't get on well with Jeremy Rockcliffe. I think this cabinet reshuffle is an attempt to try and ensure that he tries to maintain his position in the short term at the very least, with the moves like Erica Betts, like I said, getting rid of the climate change role. So I think definitely he is trying to, but you know, as they say, if a week is a long time in politics, what's 4 years, Sam?
Well, I think the one thing that is reasonably for certain at this moment in time is that I think by the end of 2024, I don't imagine Jeremy Rockcliffe to be the sole opposition leader, premier across mainland Australia and the states, because I think with Queensland and the Northern Territory coming up later in the year, we might be seeing some opposition premiers joining him in that collection.
Just a quick question, Sam, to wrap up. How would Anthony Albanese and Peter Dutton read into these results, you think?
I think the main takeaway federally from these results is just continuity, because not a huge amount has changed. The Labour Party is still out of government, and the Liberals are leading now a minority government and have fallen backwards slightly. And it sort of feeds into the same picture as we're seeing on the federal scene, which is a tightening of the federal polls, but the coalition having a pretty persistent primary vote lead with a statistical tie in the two-party preferred. So I don't think either of them are going to read too much into this, because it is actually, I think, very closely reflective of what the federal picture is, both in Tasmania and beyond. So that's my hunch.
So, welcome back to Ballot to Talk About. Now we'll be moving to the other side of the Asia Pacific region and talking about the South Korean legislative election, which actually took place a few days ago, and what turned out to be a big win for the opposition Democratic Alliance, which is led by prime which biggest constituent party is the Democratic Party. Together with the Liberals, or the center left of Korean politics, have won a clear majority, 192 seats in the 300-seat National Assembly, and an overall majority. The Democratic Alliance have 176 seats, down four, with 27% of the proportional vote. I should say one thing at this point before reading out the rest of the results, is that is to talk a little bit about South Korea's electoral system, because I think that's very key, is that of the 300 seats in the National Assembly, there were a total of 254 constituency seats elected via first past the post, and 46 seats elected via proportional representation. It's the additional member system. But it's not 50-50 in places like Germany, for example. This is very much, I would argue, a first past the post election, given the sheer number of constituencies that they are, 254. And actually, the Democratic Alliance itself won 162 constituencies and 14 proportional seats. So they actually won a majority in the entire National Assembly based purely in constituencies, which I think is fascinating. The People's Power Party, the centre-right opposition, but is the main part political vehicle behind the Conservative President Yoon Suk-yeol, has 108 seats, up two, with 37% of the proportional vote. So even though they did so much better in the proportional vote, because the pool of seats available proportionally was significantly less, that's why they're in a clear second place and lost in a landslide. Rebuilding Korea, which was allied with a former Liberal Justice Minister, has 12 seats with 24% of proportional vote. And then there were two smaller parties, New Reform and New Future, who got about four seats with about 5 or 6% of the vote. So, Sam, as I said earlier, despite the fact it's an additional member system, in effect, this was basically a first past the post election. The Democratic Alliance, I can tell readers, has got the second best result since the 1960 election. Any other reactions that you have to these results?
Yeah, I mean it's a pretty extraordinary result for the opposition. They won, as you said, 162 constituencies, which is barely changed from 2020 when they won the largest majority since the restoration of democracy in Korea. And if you include rebuilding Korea, which are very anti-Yoon Suk-yeol, this is actually the biggest opposition overall majority since the restoration of democracy in 1987. So it's a pretty extraordinary result and comes with it a lot of legislative power because, yes, South Korea has a presidential system, but the president does have exclusive power when it comes to foreign policy and constitutional matters. But any legislative procedures now that the opposition want to put in, they can basically do that without those two remits because they now have a three-fifths supermajority, which brings with it the ability to fast-track procedures and usurp and basically navigate round the presidency's policies. So despite having a conservative president in place, we now have a pretty centre-left assembly with exclusive power to pretty much do what they want in any domestic policy. And yes, they did have that for the last term, but the last time the legislative election took place, there was a Democratic Party president. So this is the first time that a supermajority has been elected with an opposition incumbent president. So, yeah, I mean, the reactions can't, I think, look any further than the fact that this is a pretty extraordinary result for the opposition to maintain what was already an extraordinary result 4 years ago.
Well, I think just one interesting fact, and then my own reaction was that one interesting fact, you want to talk about how anti-government the Rebuilding Korea, which is the party it finished third in, its leader was quoted on the campaign trail as pledging to turn Yoon into first a lame duck, then a dead duck. So I think we can expect virtually zero cooperation between Yoon Suk-yeol's People's Power Party and the third place Rebuilding Korea Party. My key reaction to this is that the Democratic Party, yes, they did lose 14 seats. The People's Party gained about two, but there wasn't really a lot of change in seat count, really, compared to 4 years ago, which is rare. I mean, if we talk about elections, Sam, we've often talked about how when governments have been tipped out or whatever, there's been this wholesale change in terms of seats. We read out where a lot of parties have collapsed. Korea seems to be the exception. But I think the underlying reasons, as you said, for this second landslide victory for the Liberals are very different. Because the last time these elections were held in April 2020,
I
there
mean,
was a Liberal president, Moon
Chern,
Jae-in
I'm just
was
going to
the
interrupt you
president.
slightly. I think we need to go back to talk about the fact that they held an election in April 2020. I mean, that for me, when I hadn't quite clocked that until I was going back to look and I was like, how did that happen? Like 15th of April 2020, we were like a month into a global pandemic, like at peak of COVID-19 lockdowns around the world, and South Korea held a legislative election. Extraordinary.
Well, I don't think many other countries can pull it off, let's put it that way. I did look up at this because I thought this was interesting. So how they conducted the elections was that you had to social distance, you had to wear face masks and stand 1 meter apart when queuing. Not sure how you could do that in so many buildings, but apparently you managed to do that when queuing or casting a vote. Before entering the polling station, you had to be checked for a fever using a thermometer, you had to use hand sanitizer, and you were issued with disposable plastic gloves. And any person with body temperature greater than 37.5, they were taken to a segregated polling booth, which was disinfected after each use. So that's how it turns out you run an election during COVID.
I mean, that's one for the history books.
That is one for history books. But yes, I also thought as well that the election was held in the later part of 2020, because I was thinking, how could you hold an election in April? But you're absolutely right to pick that up. But because I suspect of the fact that it held in April 2020, there was a big rally around the flag effect. If you recall, many governments did very well during the initial period, even the UK government. And the South Korean government had received praise from the World Health Organization, from its initial handling of the pandemic. And that benefited the incumbent liberals who were in office. So, and as you said, the landslide then was the largest majority for any party since democracy restored from 1987. But it's safe to say, Sam, that the underlying causes of this election, of why the liberals won another landslide victory, were very, very different, weren't they?
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think you're absolutely right to point out how much the political landscape in South Korea has shifted in these 4 years, because obviously now we have a conservative president. That was at the height of the pandemic. This was the first post-pandemic election, really. And obviously the global financial situation has massively shifted, and I think that had a big impact on this election. So I think the economy is huge here, because there is huge cost of living issues in South Korea. And Chern, I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about what we were talking about just prior to recording this section, which is one of Yoon Suk-yeol's biggest faux pas on this election campaign when it comes to the cost of living, because I think there was a fundamental ignorance on the part of the government to actual the extent of the cost of living crisis and inflation. I mean, just as one fact is that I saw that agricultural products particularly suffered, and that the price of apples increased 90%. There was 90% inflation on the price of apples in the last 12 months. So that's just one example of the level. But Chen, I think there's a particular story here about green onions.
Well, I'm sure. I wonder how much green onions are going to be looked upon with favor in the Yoon Suk-yeol household after this election, or in the years to come. So the problem started when President Yoon visited a grocery store in Seoul, to check on consumer prices. And this is the whole idea of cost of living is a big issue not only in South Korea but in many other countries holding democratic elections. And it was kind of a campaign gimmick to show that, hey, my government has taken action on the cost of living and has sought to reduce grocery prices. Because you talk about apples, I can tell you that the prices in of agriculture products in general is 20% higher in the month of March 2024 when you compare it to 2023, which is a huge increase. So President Yoon visited this supermarket, this grocery store in Seoul. The price of a green onion he was shown was about 875 won. And he described it as reasonable. And I think he was meant to show, and the whole idea was to show that his government has taken action to reduce the cost of living, and we can, and consumers are now feeling it. Only one slight problem with that is that it later turned out that the green onion, which was worth 875 won, was actually a discounted green onion, and that the true price of the green onion was 3,000 to 4,000 won. In other words, 3 to 4 times higher than what when President Yoon had it. And I think what it then showed is that it showed the president being out of touch with ordinary consumers on a such a hot button economic issue. And the Democratic Party, unsurprisingly, took full advantage of this fact. They started brandishing onions at campaign rallies. I think even the Electoral Commission had to step in and sit and had to try and ban that when people
Well,
were voting to sell.
they banned people from bringing green onions to polling stations, which that just shows how out of control this became. But it was absolutely latched on as being a symbol of how out of touch Yoon Suk-yeol was. But I think it's an extraordinary story, really.
And apparently, so the Electoral Commission cited, quote, election interference for the ban on green onions. But all this did was fuel further demand for green onion-themed merchandise. So beware the green onion, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, Chen, I don't think this would have been possible to have been such a drag on Yoon Suk-yeol if he wasn't already struggling in the polls, because Yoon Suk-yeol's approval rating as president is hovering around 40%, which is not diabolical, but it's certainly not brilliant, and is certainly not indicative of a party that's going to romp to legislative victory. And then, of course, also South Korea is currently experiencing a pretty severe doctor strike, which has been going since February 2024, and that's in response to government plans to increase medical student quotas. And the doctors fundamentally agree with that, fundamentally disagree with the government's assessment of the problems in hospitals. But why this has become such a problem for the government is that it's starting to have a real tangible impact on the medical profession and health services for people around the country. And no matter what the government says in these kind of times of intense strikes, I mean, I'm experiencing it firsthand in the UK, is that no matter what the government says, for the longer the public services are affected, there's still an element of resentment towards the government for not resolving the strikes in the first place. And I think that's certainly being seen in South Korea in these pretty profound doctor strikes that are going on at the moment. And that's not even talking about the corruption allegations that have been leveled at Yoon Suk-yeol. Well, to be fair, leveled at pretty much every candidate across the spectrum, but Yoon Suk-yeol is facing a particular scandal over a Dior handbag that his wife accepted, and actually South Korean electoral law bans public officials and spouses for accepting any gifts that are worth over US$750. Well, this Dior bag was worth US$2,200, so that's becoming a problem. But of course, Cho Kok, who is the leader of Rebuilding Korea, he takes the biscuit on corruption allegations because he's actually currently facing a 2-year prison sentence for forging documents for his children's university admissions. So, corruption generally across the board at the top of these elections, but for the incumbent president, it's a particular problem. So, I think the landscape wasn't that healthy for Yoon Suk-yeol. So, actually, when you start to dive into this, you begin to understand where this democratic landslide came from.
I will say this, I think even the Democratic leader was accused of corruption himself, I think.
Yeah,
So
I think some bribery charges Lee Jae-myung is facing, but well, he and also, of course, he was there was an attempted assassination on him earlier in this campaign back in January.
I think there's something to I think there's two, one question and one point is that when you have all three leaders accused of corruption, in many ways, from a South Korean voter's perspective, A, I think that makes turnout at 67%, which is the highest ever turnout for a parliamentary election, even more astonishing. Because if all three leaders, and if you're sick of dirty money in politics, and you don't really have a clean option to vote for. So I think, yes, the Dior bag scandal was probably damaging. His wife has not been seen since December of last year, purely, I suspect, for political reasons to hide her way up to the parliamentary election. Not that it did the party any much good. So I think that's the first thing to say, is that you don't really have a candidate to vote for. So I don't think that whilst it was like a major talking point, which is the general state of corruption in South Korean politics, I don't think it drove a vote for the opposition as it possibly did the cost of living, the state of the economy, or the doctor strike. So I think that's the first thing to say. And the second thing, Sam, is that what impact do you think that assassination attempt on Lee Jae-myung, do you think it helped that campaign very much at all, if at all?
Yes and no. I think it may have helped in an element of sympathy votes, as you tend to see with these kind of things, but also boosting the Democratic Party's media profile, because at least for those few weeks or the immediate aftermath, Lee Jae-myung's face was all over the media. I mean, it was in international media as well. So it's that kind of, I think it generated some sort of sense of momentum as well. But touching on your last point, which is about you don't have a clean candidate to vote for, of course, there was corruption all over the spectrum. But I think if you're facing a choice between corrupt, and then one who's corrupt and out of touch, I think that was where the clincher was.
And what I think, and I think that's really key, because why was Yoon Suk-yeol successful 2, 3 years ago compared when he was elected president compared to he is now, is that he won the vote in Seoul. And that's where the majority of the population is. And it's very clear that Seoul, or the people in Seoul, did not vote for the People's Power Party this time around. They voted en masse for the Democratic Party, and the result was that landslide itself. I also think the high turnout I talked about earlier probably meant that a lot of youth voters turn out. And as you know, because they are lower propensity voters, youth voters skew more towards the center left, as in many other developed countries. And that also benefited the liberals as well. So I think all those is very important to note as well.
So, Chen, what do you think will be the impact of this election on the remainder of Yoon Suk-yeol's presidency? Because currently he's scheduled to serve as president through to 2027. And South Korea is not particularly known for forcing out its presidents, apart from Park Geun-hye a few years ago. But so, what do you think the remainder of this presidency will look like?
Well, one small consolation for the People's Power Party, having just won over 100 seats, is that the opposition does not have a two-thirds super majority that could break a presidential veto and pass constitutional amendments. So he is a lame duck. There is no doubt about that. But he's not a complete lame duck because he can still veto legislation. And provided he keeps the People's Power Party on side, those vetoes will be sustained. So I think that's the first thing to note. I think, let's be honest, the reality is that if he wants to leave an economic legacy, he will need to work with the opposition liberals. And given they were emboldened by such a big victory, I just can't see them being in any mood to compromise with the president on many of these issues as well. And South Korea, like in many other countries, the partisanship between the liberals and the conservatives, that gap has only widened in recent years and not closed. So I just don't see something on the economic and domestic policy front, where arguably reform is much needed. I just can't see anything being done over the next 3 years. So therefore, which levers can he then pull? And therefore, you're looking at the foreign policy space, where the president, by nature of the constitution, has much more leeway being commander in chief of Korea and foreign policy as well. So I think we could see him doubling down on foreign policy issues, particularly related with South Korea's relation to the United States and trying to strengthen that as well. So I think that's one area that we could see greater engagement. Could be interesting to see how he deals with the China issue and the North Korean issue as well, and how that will play out. The North Koreans as well will know that he is a dead du lame duck. And I suspect we'll try and test him in as many ways as possible over the next 3 years as well. So I think that's what I would say is that the reality is that he's not going to get much legislation passed over the next 3 years. So he's probably going to rely on the reserve powers that were always where the president had to try and ensure that he's able to leave a legacy, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the other bigger problem for Yoon Suk-yeol is that a lot of this democratic performance was based on Lee Jae-myung's leadership. And Lee Jae-myung, of course, was defeated by Yoon Suk-yeol for the presidency back in 2022. But I would imagine that if he has any control in this at all, Lee Jae-myung will be trying to run for the presidency again in 2027. So really, are we just going to see a 3-year-long campaign for the presidency of South Korea rather than 3 years of trying to work out some sort of governing arrangement? Because obviously, Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea, the presidents are term limited to 1 5-year term. So Yoon Suk-yeol is not going to be campaigning to retain the presidency because he can't. But the person who can is the person who led this Democratic Party to another landslide victory on the legislative side and can begin his campaign for the presidency right now.
I will say this, Sam. This is. Do you know when was the last time the Conservatives won a parliamentary election?
Was it just before Park Geun-hye was impeached?
They lost a majority in that election. You had to go back to the 2012 election
Right.
in South Korea, and the lead and
Just
what
before she
happened
was elected.
exactly, and who was the leader of the Conservative Party in 2012? It was Park Geun-hye, but then again, there were 6 months between the parliamentary election and the presidential election. The reason is, of course, is that parliamentary election in South Korea takes place every 4 years, and the presidential election takes place every 5 years. So eventually, it happened to hit the midpoint for Yoon Suk-yeol. For whoever's the next president, it would take place 1 year into his term. So the cycle when the parliamentary election hits is very different depending on the presidents. But there is recent precedent of in 2012 of a leader who led their party being successfully able to run for the presidency. The question I Lee Jae-myung, I think he was hurt by Moon Jae-in's relatively unpopularity at the end, which won't be around his neck. But I'm not sure whether he is a shoo-in for the president in 2027. You know, there are 3 years more to go. I suspect the Democratic Party knows that as well, and therefore will try and do try their best to ensure that the conservatives will not get any of the credit or to help them in get any of the credit in the next 3 years to ensure that one of their own can be elected president.
Well, 3 years is a very long time in politics, so we shall see.
One final question to wrap up, Sam. I'm curious, what, just very quickly, do you think there are any lessons we can learn from both sets of parliamentary elections here?
I think for me, which is a more structural answer to this question, is that electoral systems have big impacts on the results we see. I mean, Tasmania, of course, they expanded their National Assembly and has a unique multi-member electoral system, which had a huge impact on the Liberal Party's eventual performance, but also the expansion of smaller parties being able to get into the National Assembly in Tasmania. And then obviously, on the South Korean side, they have the additional member system. They place two votes, which much benefits the parties with broader support. Because if you look at the overall proportional vote share, the People Power Party had a much higher proportional vote share than they did in terms of the overall seats they ended up with at the end. But it's the Democratic Alliance who were able to absolutely blitz their performance in the constituency seats. So electoral systems matter a lot for outcomes, and I think both of these are great examples of the different ways that can be manifested.
I think you're absolutely right, and I just will say this. Both leaders in Tasmania and South Korea, Tasmania voluntarily, Moon Suk, you'll face a fixed one, have both emerged probably weaker from these election results than they entered beforehand, which I don't think many, well, certainly from lesser to lesser extent, I don't think Moon Suk, you expected his position to be this much weaker, because this was, let's beat no bones, but terrible performance for the center right People's Power Party. And Jeremy Rockliffe has had to cobble together a much more difficult coalition and had to hold it over the next 4 years, which is a long period of time. So I think the both takeaways is that both leaders have emerged weaker within their parties and their ability to exert influence, and we can see that with Jeremy Rockliffe's cabinet changes are very much diminished following these election results. And we should say as well that in South Korea's case, I think the prime minister has offered to resign, which is an easy way for somebody to take account and responsibility. But on that note, that is it for this latest episode of Ballot to Talk About. We'll be back to doing weekly episodes for this next little while because of the sheer number of elections coming up. And so do join us again next week when we'll be reviewing the results of parliamentary elections in Croatia and previewing the big general election in South Africa. As always, we'll continue to keep you up to date on the world of politics and elections from around the world. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at ballot underscore talk. And please do leave us a rating or review or simply tell your friends about us. You can also email any feedback or comments to ballottotalkabout@gmail.com. My name is Chen Han, and until next time, we'll speak to you soon.